I'm John Forsyth, and I'm sitting with Jim Rainey, Professor Emeritus from the College of Business at Michigan State University. This is May 21st, 2009, and we're doing a conversation related to the project of the MSU Faculty Emeriti Association, trying to collect what we call oral history or reminiscences of people that have provided important service to Michigan State University. So thank you for doing this, Jim. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Why don't we start? If people end up at Michigan State University from all kinds of different backgrounds, so if you want to give me a brief synopsis of where you grew up and how you got to Michigan State University.
I'll do that. I grew up in the northern suburbs of Chicago, Wilmette and Glencoe. I attended Neutra Township High School, which has always been very highly regarded.
A public high school.
Public high school.
Very high.
Yes.
Ratings, yes.
I did my undergraduate degree in chemical engineering at the University of Notre Dame. And the only thing I knew at the end of that 4 years was I didn't want to be a chemical engineer. So I had two choices, business school or law school, and I was admitted to the University of Chicago Law School. Thought I better not pass up that opportunity. At that time, I thought I might be a patent lawyer, but I changed my mind. At any rate, I finished my law degree, and I happened to be in the lounge of the law school, and in walked a gentleman named Milton Bartram Dickerson, who was the chairperson of the Department of Business Law, Insurance, and Office Administration here at MSU. At that time, they had a program where you would come to Michigan State, you would teach business law for a year and do an MBA. It had never occurred to me that I would have a career in academia, but I said, okay, I'll come up to East Lansing and spend a year, and then I'll go out to make my fortune with my MBA and my law degree. That was 45 years ago.
Was that 1954?
1964. One thing led to another and another and another, and I'm still at it. Go ahead.
Well, yes. In fact, now what was your official date of retirement?
December 2004.
So
December 2004.
About 4.5 years past that.
And
you are still actively involved with the university, although on.
I have a quarter-time appointment in the School of Hospitality Business. The director of the school, Ron Chickie, worked for me in the Undergraduate Advising Center in 1975 when he was doing an MBA. And we've been friends ever since. And when he learned I was going to retire, he said, you mustn't go home and put your feet up. And so he said, come and work with me. So I am now the director of academic programs in the school on a quarter-time basis.
On a quarter-time basis.
Right.
Well, how many years were you the associate dean in the College of Business?
I spent 30 years in the dean's office.
In the dean's office.
I started in July of 1969 as the assistant dean for undergraduate programs.
Mm-hmm.
Became the associate dean for undergraduate programs. And then when Dick Lewis became the dean in 1975, he said, let's put all of the graduate and undergraduate deaning together, and you can do the job. I was a little concerned about that, but it worked out. So from 1975 through 1999, I was the associate dean for academic affairs.
Do you know if any other colleges at the university have tried that approach? I'm out of the College of Engineering, and we've always had separate associate deans.
Dick was very conservative, and he did not want that number of administrators in the dean's office. So we put it together, and it, as I say, seemed to work out.
So it sounds as if you did about 15 years of teaching.
I taught every year while I was in the dean's office, one course, business law, typically, either at the undergraduate or MBA level.
So they had courses at both levels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And One course a year?
I taught one a year. For many, many years, of course, we were on the quarter system and made the conversion to semesters, as you know.
So your workload went up.
That's right.
All right. So was Professor Dickerson looking for a number of people to come to participate in that program, or was he, did he have his sights set on you? Or?
They typically brought in one law school graduate each year, and they would visit the University of Michigan, the University of Chicago, looking for these assistant instructors, as we were called. So I was an assistant instructor the first year, and about halfway through that year, Bart Dickerson said, why don't you spread the rest of your MBA out over a second year? And so I became an instructor. And then in the middle of the second year, he said, gee, we don't have anything more available. So I took my first airplane ride and flew to Syracuse, New York, and they sent me a nice offer to become an assistant professor of business law. But the day I got back here, a position opened up, and I don't have any idea what the dynamics were involved, but I thought this is the place I ought to be, so I accepted the position.
So the what do you recall about some of those early? You came to campus at a time when we were getting into some of the turmoil, student unrest and turmoil and so forth. And did you see that in your classes? Did you?
Let me talk about one other thing before we get to that.
Okay.
One of the most interesting assignments I ever had was to the student faculty judiciary. Very soon after I got here, Bart Dickerson became the vice president for student affairs, and he called and asked if I would serve on the early, very early version of the student faculty judiciary. This was a group established by the In the Academic Freedom Report for students at Michigan State University. And I served for 7 years as the vice chairman of that group. I was in on the early days, so I had a chance as a lawyer to help draft a lot of the procedures and so forth that were utilized in hearings of one sort or another. I worked with Ruth Renault and Joy Tubaugh in the office of the Student Affairs Office, two terrific people who dedicated their lives to Michigan State.
I suppose this is in the nature of full disclosure, but that's where I met you, because I was on the student faculty issue. You had already been in harness there for at least a couple of years, I think, at the time.
I think the appointments were five-year terms, and then I stayed for two more. And then I went back to it after another 10 or so years. But the purpose of the group changed quite a bit in that 10-year period.
It did?
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of the issues that came before that group when I was on it, and this would have been in your first tenure on the judiciary, they stemmed somewhat from the student unrest, some of the confrontations, and there were also other sorts of things that came that had to do with, well, students not following some of the rules and regulations of the university, and when that got to be problematical, sometimes a faculty member or an assistant dean or someone would refer that situation to the student faculty judiciary.
Right. I can recall some of the early cases were very interesting, whether ROTC ought to be on the campus, what ought to happen to demonstrators who sat in at Linton Hall, which was then the administration building, and they were removed by the police, and they were charged civilly. Should we have a hearing and determine their status in the university before the criminal courts took a look at it? There was a pet policy, what kinds of pets were allowed in the dormitory besides goldfish. We're sitting in the library. There was a question about why undergraduate students couldn't access the new graduate wing, what kind of discrimination was that. At any rate, those, in addition to academic dishonesty cases, kept us very, very busy in the early years.
And some of that, you mentioned one thing, I think, with respect to discipline and handling problems within the university that do become civil matters, and I think the people who have to deal with that have a fine line to walk to not interfere with the judicial process that's outside the university.
Absolutely.
And whether it would advantage or disadvantage the individual.
Mm-hmm.
That's and I don't know the answers to those. I did that for 5 years, and I still don't.
I think there's still questions. I'm sure there's still questions. In terms of student unrest, we in the business school were a target of a sense because we were part of what was called the military-industrial complex, and the study of business at that time was not popular. I can recall that at one point a group of demonstrators did come to Epley Center, which was our home at that time, and they threw some rocks and they shattered some of the glass doors at the front of the building, but nothing other than that. I think Michigan State had a number of students who participated in demonstrations of one sort or another. But we had one advantage, the size of the campus. It was more troublesome if you were at Columbia or you were at Berkeley because everyone congregated in a central place. Here, the police could run them into the cornfields and they had a hard time getting organized. But I do recall the tires burning on Grand River Avenue across from the student union, things of that sort. But I think in terms of the overall situation, we had minor unrest.
I think I'd have to agree. You mentioned that at that time the study of business was not popular in the sense that you didn't have the large enrollment pressures that I think we see at that college today.
That is correct.
But what's your sense of how that's affected the college and the programs in the college?
When I became the assistant dean for undergraduate programs in 1969, we had about 3,400 undergraduates.
That's
a fairly large unit relative to the other colleges. But our enrollment after the Vietnam War ended and the economy tightened up, our enrollment at its peak was 7,300 undergraduate students, plus about 700 MBA and doctoral students. So we had 8,000 students in the business school, and that presented a number of challenges. We're accredited by an independent agency, and one of the measures they use in terms of a continuing accreditation is the student-faculty ratio. So our accreditation was actually threatened at a couple of points in time because of that major increase from 3,400 to 7,300. And, of course, we were hiring faculty as quickly as we could, budget permitting. But we felt those pressures for many, many years.
When the budget allowed, were there sufficient candidates available? In terms of the academic needs of the college, or did you sometimes have to?
I think for the most part, of course, one of the results of the pressures here and elsewhere for the need for faculty was that faculty salaries for assistant professors also skyrocketed along with our undergraduate enrollment. So that then led to salary compression, where we have assistant professors coming in at salaries close to or even above those of some of the faculty who have been in the ranks for a number of years. And that has always, that's been a problem.
And continues, doesn't it?
Continues right now.
It continues. But the enrollment that you're talking about is College of Business is one of, 15 or 17 colleges at the university, and it had 20% of the enrollment.
For a long time, we were the largest college in terms of student population. I believe today we're second. I think natural science is probably a bit larger, and social science is very close.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Aside from the student faculty judiciary, are there issues related to students, either graduate or undergraduate, that stick in your mind that you think about when you think back about the time that you spent in the college?
Well, another assignment, of course, that an assistant or associate dean has is membership on the associate assistant dean's committee. And in the early days, that committee, though we had two subcommittees, undergraduate and graduate, but the assistant associate dean's group had a lot of flexibility in terms of the issues they dealt with and the policies that they developed. Now, this all precedes academic governance, and we were able to accomplish a lot, simply the group, you know, working together, representing all of the colleges across campus. Mm-hmm. Once we started hiring assistant provosts and involving everyone in the very complex committee structure we have, it became more difficult for us to function. Obviously, we mm-hmm. continued to meet and we had input, but we had to involve a lot of other players in the decision-making process.
You still had that role when the university changed from the quarter system to the semester system?
Yes, yes.
That was kind of a complicated process that I went through under kind of a very stringent timeline. And that the assistant associate dean's group tried to provide guidance with that, along with the university committee on curriculum.
And we had a special committee that I chaired for 4 years. It was a policy review committee, and it consisted of representatives from many offices. The idea was to try to measure the impact of the new student information system on various policies and procedures. So we converted to the semester system at the very same time we introduced a very complex way of keeping student records. Prior to the student information system, they indicated there were 13 separate paper files on students in various offices across the campus, health center, police, on and on and on. But the student information system project was a very complex thing in and of itself, and it was fascinating.
More than just the computer programs involved.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Do you think there are now fewer than 13 files?
I'm sure there are fewer, but I know that I, for one, fight against eliminating paper altogether. So the rule in the business college was always paper to Rainey, and I'll look at the computer screen when I'm absolutely pushed.
Uh-huh.
But at any rate, I'm sure there are far fewer files, paper files across the campus.
I know that the university is trying to become paperless.
Yes.
And I really wonder if the university buys less paper today than it did 10 years ago.
They say not. They say
I think not myself.
Even though we're printing on both sides but of the page. But I think there's still as much paper in the system as there was.
Yeah. Do you have any recollections about students in classes that stick out? Are there things that affected the way you teach your classes? Or
there's a very distinct difference between the behavior of undergraduate students and MBA candidates, for example. Undergraduate students tended, and to a certain extent still do, take notes, and they believe what it is you tell them. MBA students, quite the opposite. They will take notes, but they'll take you on very directly if they think they know more about what happens in the so-called real world than you do.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of students overall, obviously, we had the activists in the late 60s and 1970s, but the level of activism then declined substantially, mm-hmm. and we haven't seen anything close to that since that time. One of the interesting things that's happened in terms of students is that they are now consumers. In an early day, the students weren't quite so interested, you know, in the amount of money they're spending in terms of tuition and fees. But now it's my feeling that they would like you to inject knowledge in the least painful form. They'd prefer to have a show as opposed to simply a lecture because of the way they've been raised and mm-hmm. the impact of technology, you know, on the way they live their lives. But they would like, again, to have knowledge injected, and they would like to have a four-point grade. And you've heard of the concept of the helicopter parents who are hovering above, and it's amazing. We've even had parents come to interviews for MBA applicants.
And really?
Yes. And, of course, we offer them a cup of coffee and a newspaper, and we don't have them in the interview room. But the idea that a parent would come and inquire about the likelihood of an MBA candidate being admitted is still hard for me to understand.
Yes. I have to tell you a story. When my daughter went to a graduate school, at the end of the first term, they were on a quarter system. Mm-hmm. The grades came to our house, and this is after she was a university graduate, not this university, and had worked for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I didn't open the grades. I knew mm-hmm. from the appearance of the envelope what it was, and I called her, and I couldn't resist. Michigan State having long ago recognized that these 18 and 21 year old students were above the age of majority, and they got their grades. And it was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon here when I called her, and I think the problem was resolved about 8:01 the next morning. But I'm not sure why that university thought that the grade should come to her parents, but in our family, we had long, you know, about the time they enrolled as freshmen in college, we tried to back off and let them run their own affairs, but not all parents see it that way. So the MBA candidates offer you a bit of a challenge when they have an opportunity.
That's correct.
That's interesting.
That's correct. And we have actually three different MBA programs. We have an executive MBA mm-hmm. program for people with at least 10 years of work experience, and then we have a weekend MBA program for those who are full-time employed, and then we have a full-time daytime program. And even the dynamics amongst those groups differs. One example, we ask the MBA students to do a very brief study abroad in the summer between their first summer abroad experience between their first and second year, and we ask them to sign a form. This is a university form, and one of the things that they are supposed to do is hold the university harmless for any problems they create, and their estate are supposed to hold the university harmless in the event that they are harmed in some fashion or other. And it's fascinating, the executive MBA students take the form to their lawyers in the corporate offices, and they come back with initials and things scratched out. The full-time MBAs read the form, and they raise questions. But when you submit a form like that to an undergraduate, they sign it without reading it at all. So there are differences when you move from one level to another.
Well, I think it shows they've progressed.
Yeah, well, I think that's right.
Now, the executive, is that the one that's that works in...
That's offered in Troy.
In Troy.
Which is a northern Detroit suburb. And we have our own building called the Management Education mm-hmm. Center that was actually built for us more than 30 years ago by the automotive companies mm-hmm. in the main and the suppliers to automotive companies. It's still a very nice facility. And we've I've been very pleased with the support historically we've had. Now times are tough, and we're having a difficult time filling those classes.
But then the weekend MBA, they come to campus. How often? Once a month?
Well, they come to campus for an intense week at the start of the program, and then they come to campus every other weekend, typically. Every other weekend. And we have a very fine facility, the James B. Henry Center.
Yes.
Appended to the University Club.
Yes.
And then appended to that is a Candlewood Suites, which is a long-term stay facility that was given to us, or will be given to us, after a period of years. But so the students come every other weekend, and they stay at the Candlewood Suites, and they have their classes in the Henry Center, and then the University Club provides the food service.
How does the intensity of that program affect the students and the faculty?
I think the intensity of that program is very difficult for both students and faculty to deal with. They have classes on Friday evening until 10 or 10:30, and then they have classes beginning at 8 o'clock Saturday morning until about 5 in the afternoon. And I worry personally about the ability to assimilate information. And I think I always say to students, whether you're going to graduate school in business or you're going to law school, if you can do it at all, do a full-time program where you devote all of your time and energy to academics. Lots of people, of course, do evening programs or weekend programs, and that's okay, but I think the full-time experience is much more beneficial.
How long does it take to do the weekend program? Is it 2 years?
The executive program is a full 2 years. Weekend program is about a year and 6 months. Year, 6 months, or 7 months.
Do you think the students' learning strategies changes during that period?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, of course, we rely very heavily in MBA programs on teamed, mm-hmm. based instruction, and on the use of cases like mm-hmm. one finds in a law school setting, so that the students are divided into teams and they're analyzing cases that have been built on, again, the so-called real-world experiences of major corporations. So, working
do the interpersonal dynamics ever get testy with those teams under that pressure?
They certainly do. We try. We work very hard to, when we put the teams together, mm-hmm. we take into account the students' backgrounds and their functions in the firm. Sometimes, yes, the teaming doesn't work. There's another issue I'll mention. We have a very large number of international students in our full-time MBA mm-hmm. program. Sometimes as high as 40 to 45% international. The cultural differences, especially the students from the Far East, can create difficulties because the students, and even in Europe, the students don't challenge faculty members. They listen to lectures, take notes, memorize the material, and then report it back. But in terms of the international students from the Far East, they are very quiet, they are very reserved, so to get them to actively engage in a discussion, and there's a lot of that, of course, in a team-based course with cases, to get them to participate in classroom discussions is very challenging, and also to get them to work in a team is challenging. I'm sure their preference would be to be with a group of their own. But we, again, break them up and put them in with the domestic students. And the dynamics there often don't work very well.
I think sometimes, you know, faculty get into their positions because of their discipline and their interest in their discipline, but they're not necessarily educated in these cultural differences. And it must be one of the challenges for the faculty to do this? Do you have mechanisms to help them with that or advise them?
There are more now than there were certainly 10 or 15 years ago. There was nothing 10 or 15 years ago. In fact, I was surprised, going back to Bart Dickerson, the first course I taught had nothing to do with my background. He needed someone to teach a course in real estate development and appraisal. And I said, I don't know anything about real estate development and appraisal. I could teach a real estate law class. He said, we have that one covered. So he handed me a textbook and a class list and said, take a crack at it. And I sometimes tell people, you know, that there is no licensing of college professors like there is for teachers at the elementary and high school levels. But there's more help available now, but it is not all that extensive either in terms of understanding teaching techniques or cultural differences and things of that kind.
Well, our involvement with international students or having them as students on campus has grown, I think, all over the university in the last 20 years.
Yes.
And they bring a lot, but they also bring things that maybe not everybody understands.
That's exactly right.
And it's sometimes difficult to know when you're in that situation and trying to learn what's going on. Do these students, by and large, return to their home countries with the MBA, or do they try to stay in the U.S.?
A large number of them would prefer to stay in the U.S., but as a practical matter, it's extremely difficult for them to find a job. The visa requirements and so forth, and they're even more stringent or strict now than they were 10 years ago, but most of them do eventually return home to their own countries. Certainly the ones who are sponsored by their employer return home. Because the position is being held for them, and their compensation's increased because they have done an MBA in the U.S. So.
And then their value in their home country is their experience with the American culture and an understanding of American business.
Almost more the culture than the business techniques. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at a Germany or you look at a Japan, they have better techniques in some senses than we do. In fact, several years ago, there was an interesting article written, and the premise was that business in Japan did far better because they didn't have MBA programs. And that dialogue continues today, especially after these current financial problems.
Yes.
In the U.S. in particular, and then that spread around the world.
Do you want to talk about the current financial problems or how the people in those positions got into that situation? Or?
Our interim dean, Alvin Lashbrook, just returned recently from a meeting of our accrediting agency. Mm-hmm. And one of the speakers, who is a business school dean, said that business schools were in the main responsible for most of these financial challenges that we face. He was, of course, greeted with not boos, but a lot of negative feelings.
Some hostility.
Some hostility, that's right. We try now, we didn't always, you know, to talk about social responsibility and ethics and things of that kind, but most of us feel we're not responsible for the greedy behavior of the business executives in the financial sector, but we're going to have to do more. We're going to have to do more. For a long time, we have had an ethics class in our full-time MBA program, and the student reaction has not been positive.
In what sense?
They would
rather not take it. Or?
The students fill out a rating form at the end of the semester.
Oh yes.
And they very often will say something to the effect that Professor X teaches us how to behave, everyone else teaches us how to make money. And
Well, the,
that isn't a reason to take the course out of the curriculum, but it tells you something about them, and maybe we are responsible but for the financial mess. But
it's
sort of telling.
Well, from what I understand about some of the compensation techniques in the financial industry, you didn't have to be terribly greedy to think that some of the options looked attractive.
Absolutely.
Because there was quite a lot of compensation there if you knew how to do it.
People were the general public in particular, were very surprised about these large bonuses that mm-hmm. are given automatically regardless of your performance and the performance of your firm.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, well, these are to keep our people so that they won't be bid away by a competitor. But some of that, I think, is a bit nonsensical. The idea that you are automatically entitled to a bonus as a yeah. matter of contract, I think, is not a very helpful
yes.
concept.
Let's see. As the enrollment grew, if we looked at business law classes, the size of a business law, a section of a business law class increased similarly over the years?
Yes. The courses that I taught were always required, either at the undergraduate or MBA levels. And the conversion to the semester system increased the size of most every class offered almost automatically, because when you have a chance to teach it only twice a year instead of three times, you're going to increase the enrollment.
Mm-hmm.
My own view was that David Scott, who was the provost, who proposed this change, was interested only in economics. And he said, the only way you can get a quality education is to study on the semester system. But that's ridiculous. Stanford and Chicago and Yale are all still on the quarter system, and I think they turn out a pretty decent product.
But, Cornell and Northwestern and
some of the others.
Notable universities,
right.
Yes.
So if you convert to a semester system, again, you reduce the number of times you have to teach, and you reduce the number of faculty you need, but you also decrease the options available to both faculty and students in terms of the number of courses that are available. So I kept all my notes hoping that we would go back the other way someday. Ohio State did, but we have not and never will.
No. Okay. The situation with the business law class, where the one course is required in the curriculum, and it will be probably as long as there's an accreditation
yes.
issue, I don't see how you could leave that out of the curriculum. But then that was a mechanism for increasing teaching load.
Increasing teaching load, and it in some senses forced you to change the way you examine students. I always, and that's one reason I stopped teaching 2 years ago, I always required essay exams.
Oh.
And because I think in law, it's all shades of gray. There's nothing black and white, and how you interpret the fact pattern and how you argue is going to have a major impact on the way you resolve the issues. And I guess you can do that with a multiple choice objective test, but I think that it's necessary to write. And I did all the grading myself. Since our graduate assistants or teaching assistants didn't have law backgrounds, it would take me longer to explain to them how to grade an exam than it would be worth. And so I did all the grading, and it took weekends and nights. And as the enrollments increased, I just said, well, I've done this long enough.
They weren't increasing the number of hours in the day. So I probably shouldn't try to pigeonhole you, but you have engineering background, you have law background, you have business, which includes probably finance and accounting and all that, and in terms of your formal training. So what are you?
I'm a puzzle. Let me tell you a cute story. For many years, a gentleman named Dick Henson, Richard Henson, was in charge of transfer admissions. And he told me one day that whenever he got a, he had a student, a teary-eyed freshman, to be in front of him, the freshman said, "I don't know what I want to do with my life." He would say, "Let me tell you about a good friend of mine in the College of Business." And then he would talk about chemical engineering and law and MBA. And I, of course, used that myself when I counsel students. I said, it's good to have a plan, plan A and a plan B, but you really need to be flexible, because so much of life is going to be determined, your outcome in life is going to be determined. You have to have some basic skills, but it's also going to depend on who you meet and how the network develops, and a good portion of it's going to be pure luck. So I consider my being here for 45 years has a big element of luck in it. Who would have thought I'd meet Bart Dickerson, you know, in the lounge of the law school? And who would have thought?
Now, this wasn't by appointment.
No, no. He was, he just walked by and introduced himself. And so one thing led to another and another and another. It's worked very well.
Well, I have a student who has become a good friend, and he was an undergraduate student in computer science, and finally after working in that area, fulfilling his ROTC and further obligations, the upshot of it is that he's an orthodontist.
Oh, really?
Yes. And a very good one. And so I understand exactly the principle you're talking about, that they want to do well with their talents. But
I think of our graduating class in chemical engineering at the undergraduate level, I think there were 30 or 35 of us who finished, and I think only five or six
practiced
chemical engineering. We didn't go on a field trip until the senior year, and we went to Gary, Indiana, and we watched steel being made and antifreeze and paint, and we all said, who would ever want to work in an environment like this? We had laboratory work, of course, but it was in a very clean, almost sterile environment. When you go out and get see the sights and smells, why, we all changed our minds. Speaking of students as friends, one of the most enjoyable experiences I've had is doing study abroad with students. For 4 years in the late 80s, early 90s, I took business students to Rotterdam in the Netherlands for spring term. And actually, I shared the instruction with Cecil Mackey, who was the president at, of the university at that time. I would take them in early April, and he and Claire would come in the middle of May, and I'd come back to do term end sorts of activities here. But I have three students who went with me to the Netherlands and never came back. Well, they came back to graduate, but and their parents have never forgiven me. But every summer I go to Amsterdam, and my excuse is I have to check on my students to make sure they're all right. But one is with a major accounting firm, another is with what used to be called the ABN AMRO Bank, and the third one is with Vodafone, which is a huge international communications business. So
now, were these, was this an undergraduate?
These were undergraduate students, and at that, when the program started, we decided we had to do our own teaching, because all the instruction at Erasmus University in Rotterdam was in Dutch. And it's not an easy language to learn, and if you learned it, I'm not sure what you would do with it in the long run. But so we always did our own instruction. And we took a week-long bus trip to Paris and Brussels, and it was a terrific experience for students. So I am a very strong advocate for study abroad, regardless of the length of the stay. I think you get so much out of it. And the students put that on their resume, and they would report to me that was always the first question a, an interviewer would ask. Tell me about your study abroad. Because it showed you were flexible and motivated and a risk taker, and so it has had a number of benefits.
Have all three of those learned Dutch?
They all have.
Yes.
One has become a Dutch citizen, Now, that process is very, very lengthy, but they all speak very fluent Dutch, and they're very, very pleased with their lives.
Let's talk for just a minute about the work you're doing now in the School of Hospitality Business. Mm-hmm. And was there a person in your position before you did it?
No, there was not. In terms of the enrollment in hospitality, we have about 850 undergraduates, and we have about 30 graduate students. And for many, many years, all of the student affairs work was done by a single individual. That person served as the academic advisor, the admissions officer, the graduation certification person for that total population. Again, I mentioned Ron Chickie, the director. He knew that that was a very stressful kind of a job and almost an impossible sort of a job. But when I retired, he said, "Why don't you come on over and take a look at this and then tell me what we ought to be doing?" So as a result of that, we've hired two undergraduate advisors and a coordinator for graduate students. Mm-hmm. So we've gone from one full-time person to one full-time and two at 90% time. So mm-hmm. we have really improved, I think, the level of service for all of the students. We would like to grow the graduate program. We'd like to have more than 30 students, but we're going to have to watch carefully with the 850 undergraduates because it's a small faculty.
Do you think that those undergraduates come with a realistic impression of what the hospitality business is like when they're going to graduate, if they graduate and practice in that area?
It varies greatly from one student to another. A fair number of them come from families in hospitality. They come from families who own restaurants, or they come from a family where one parent or the other is a hotel manager, something of this kind. Mm-hmm. But because of the difference in the way you spend your professional life, we require, and it's the only program in the business school, we require two internships. Mm-hmm. These students are going to, one of the things we say...
These would be a semester at a time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. You're going to be working when everybody else is playing. And
yes.
You're going to be working late into the night.
Yes.
And you're going to have to step in and wash dishes on occasion. You're going to have to make beds. And there's nothing quite like it in any other business field. So a fair number of the students start in hospitality, but then they move away and take other kinds of career paths. Mm-hmm. But those who are dedicated...
These are the graduates.
These are the graduates, mm-hmm. Yes. But those who are interested in it, dedicated to it, love it.
I see.
And they typically start out at a fairly low entry wage. Entry salary, but they can move up very, very quickly. But it's an interesting field also. People can succeed and become managers and high-level executives in hotel companies without an undergraduate degree. You can still do that. You can start at a very low level, and if you're patient, you can work up and up and up and have a very fine executive-level position.
Is that getting more difficult?
Oh, yes. Yes. One other thing I'll mention, we did have an MBA major in hospitality for some time, but we dropped that because for a long, long time, hospitality business didn't know what to do with MBAs. Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't know where to place them, and so they would place them at the same level as the undergraduate students, mm-hmm. at a very low salary. Now, of course, we have mega corporations, you know, the Marriotts and mm-hmm. the Hiltons and so forth and so on, the Starwoods. Now they know what to do with MBAs, mm-hmm. and they're very sophisticated business organizations. But for a long time, again, the MBA wasn't the credential you would want going into hospitality.
But even in the corporate offices, they must want people who served in the front lines and really understand what the...
Yes.
But the manager and the assistant manager
absolutely.
At the hotel has to
absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely. Service, the service industry is a totally different animal mm-hmm. than you find elsewhere. So,
you think, is there some question I should have asked you that I haven't thought of? Or that you thought, what was the question you didn't want me to ask?
Well, the one you asked. Who are you? What are you?
Well, do you think all of that, though, must affect the way you work? Your engineering background must have. I wonder if you ever think about that with your colleagues in the college, that you think that you do things maybe a little differently because you had that engineering background.
I think probably I'm sure the reason I was admitted to the University of Chicago, well, there were two reasons. My parents were both medical doctors, and they did their degrees at Chicago. Okay. That has some impact at a school like that. Mm-hmm. But also I think the fact that I was an engineer impressed the admissions people, because they know engineers work very hard, or at least they have to spend a lot of time studying. So mm-hmm. I think that had some impact. Another cute story that I like to tell. When I came here, I went back and visited some of my law school faculty instructors, and one of them said, "Why are you now pursuing a lesser degree?" Because I had a JD,
yes,
a Juris Doctor, and I was doing an MBA. So I dealt with that. And then after I was here for a few years, a senior business school faculty member said, "You know, I want to offer you some advice." He said, "If you're going to make progress here, you need to study for the doctorate." He said, "I know you have a doctorate, but you've got to study for the doctorate." And, of course, he meant the PhD.
Yes.
I never did that, of course, and I think I've had a pretty successful time. And I never went back and told him what I thought of his advice. But the games we play.
Yes, yeah, yes. Well, I think we've covered quite a bit of ground here. I want to thank you for taking the time out to sit down here and put some thoughts down. Is there a final, any kind of a comment you'd want to make?
That this has been a very enjoyable hour. And I think it gave me, thinking about the fact I was coming here, gave me a chance to reflect on a long history, and in fact, I got out copies of old resumes so that I'd remember what it is I have done over the years.
Over 45 years, there's a lot to remember.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Very good. Thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you.